After a few minutes, I shouted out happily to Rachel, 40 minutes to open a head, 10 minutes to remove the tumour, and it's all out, and the brain looks perfect. Wonderful, she said, though I doubted if I was forgiven. I left Mike to close up the old lady's head and sat down in a corner of the theatre to write an operating note. It took another 40 minutes to finish the operation, and the patient was being wheeled off to the intensive care unit by 5 p.m. Mike and I left the theatres and walked round the wards to see our inpatients. Apart from the two surgical cases we had just done, there were only a few patients recovering uneventfully from relatively minor spinal operations done 2 days earlier, so the ward round took only a few minutes and we ended up on the ITU. Examining patients at the end of the operating list, making sure that they are, as the jargon has it, awake and fully orientated with a GCS of 15, is an important part of the neurosurgeon's day. Mrs. Seagrave was sitting half upright in her bed, with drip stands and syringe pumps and monitors with flashing displays beside her. With so much technology, it is hard to believe that anything can go wrong. But what really matters is that a nurse wakes the patient up every 15 minutes to make sure that they are alert and not slipping into a coma caused by post-operative bleeding. A nurse was cleaning blood and bone dust from her hair. I had finished the operation in a hurry and had forgotten to wash and blow-dry her hair, something I usually do with female patients. "It all went perfectly," I said, leaning slightly over her from the side of the bed. Mrs. Seagrave reached out for my hand and held it tightly. "Thank you," she said, in a voice a little hoarse from the anaesthetic tube. "All out and definitely benign," I said. I turned away and went to see the man with the trigeminal neuralgia who was in the bed next to hers. He was asleep, and I shook him gently. He opened his eyes and looked a little groggily at me. "How's your face feel?" I asked. He cautiously touched his cheek. Before the operation, doing this would have caused him the most terrible agony. He looked surprised and prodded his cheek a little more forcefully. "It's gone," he said in an awestruck voice and smiled happily. "That's wonderful!" "The op went fine," I said. "Definite artery on the nerve. Consider yourself cured." I saw no need to mention the awful bleeding. I went down the stairs to my office to see if there was any more paperwork to be done, but just for once Gail had left my office empty. It had been a good day. I had not lost my temper. I had finished the list. The patients were well. The pathology had been benign. I had been able to cancel the two spines at the beginning of the list rather than at the end. There were no major problems with the patients on the wards. What more could a surgeon want? On my way out, I passed Anthony, who was coming in for the evening shift. I asked about the old lady with a chronic subdural who wanted to die. "I think they operated," he said. He headed off to the wards, and I walked out into the night. Mrs. Seagrave's daughter was standing outside the hospital entrance, beside the railings where I padlocked my bicycle, smoking a cigarette. "How did it go?" she asked when she saw me. "It went perfectly," I replied. "She might be a bit confused for a few days, but I think she'll make a very good recovery." "Well done," she said. I told her that it was largely a matter of luck, but she probably didn't believe me. They never do when an operation has gone well. "I'm sorry I lost my temper with your registrar yesterday," she began. "Don't think about it," I replied cheerfully. "I was an angry relative myself once." Chapter 8. Choroid plexus papilloma. Noun. A benign tumour of the choroid plexus, a structure made from tufts of villi within the ventricular system that produces cerebrospinal fluid. 30 years ago, British hospitals always had a junior doctor's bar where you could go for a drink at the end of a long day or where, if you had any free time, you could spend the evening smoking and drinking when on call or playing on the Space Invaders or Pac-Man machines in a corner of the room. I was working as a gynecological houseman and had only been qualified as a doctor for 4 months. It was to be 18 months before I saw the operation that convinced me to become a neurosurgeon. I was standing at the bar one evening, drinking beer and gossiping with colleagues, probably discussing patients and their illnesses in that slightly swaggering way that young doctors have when talking to each other. I was probably also feeling a little guilty about not returning home more promptly to see my wife Hilary and our 3-month-old son William when my bleep announced an outside call. I found the nearest phone to be told by Hilary, who sounded desperate, that our son had been admitted to the local hospital, seriously ill, with some kind of problem in his brain. I remember very clearly how I ran from the hospital to the underground station, and once off the train, sick with anxiety, sprinted through the dark and deserted back streets of Balham. It was winter, and it was already late in the evening, to the local hospital. There I found a distraught Hilary in a quiet side room, our baby son sleeping restlessly in her arms, and a consultant paediatrician who had waited for my arrival. He told me that William had acute hydrocephalus and would be transferred to the Children's Hospital at Great Ormond Street the next day for a brain scan. My wife and I spent the next few weeks in that strange world one enters when you fear for your child's life. The outside world, the real world, becomes a ghost world, and the people in it remote and indistinct. The only reality is intense fear, a fear driven by helpless, overwhelming love. He was transferred on a Friday afternoon, never a good time to fall seriously ill, and a brain scan was organized. Because I was a doctor myself, and the junior doctor looking after William turned out, by an odd coincidence, to be an old school friend of Hilary's, I was allowed to stand in the control room for the scanner. It was strange to hear the two radiographers happily chatting about a party they'd been to, detached and uninterested in the little baby wrapped in a blanket, who could be seen through the control room window, lying in the big mechanical donut of the machine, with his mother, looking drawn and desperate, sitting beside him. I watched the images appearing on the computer screen as the scanner slowly worked its way up through William's head. They showed acute hydrocephalus and a tumour immediately in the centre of his brain. He was taken back to the ward from the scanner. I was told the consultant surgeon would be coming to see him later. William was now obviously, or at least it looked obvious to me, unconscious and very ill, but I was assured by the surgical registrar that he was just sleeping off the sedation he had been given for the scan. The afternoon passed, and it became dark outside. We were then told that possibly the consultant surgeon would not be coming until the following Monday. In a kind of fugue state, I wandered around the hospital's long corridors, now largely empty, helplessly trying to find the consultant, a man who seemed to have become as mythical as the neurosurgeons in my own hospital. And eventually, despairing, unable to stand it any longer, I abandoned my wife and child and went home, where I smashed a kitchen chair in front of my alarmed parents and swore to sue the hospital if William came to any harm. While I was failing so dismally to cope with the situation, the surgeon had, I later learned, appeared, taken one look at William and ushered Hilary out of the room. He inserted emergency drains into William's brain through the fontanelle to relieve the build-up of pressure. At least, in retrospect, I could claim to have been right to have been so frightened. We were told that an operation to remove the tumour would take place 5 days later. The 5 days were torture. When I drove home the night before the operation, a black cat